Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review. The first Democrat drops out of the governor's primary. And federal data shows that Wisconsin's SNAP error rate is low. Plus, Wisconsin Republicans split over a 65-year-old federal sports law. All that and more on Rewind, your week in review for June 26th. I'm Ani van Wagtendonk.
And I'm Scott Bauer.
Welcome to Rewind. We had a nice and kind of organized news week this week. We have a couple different categories. The big news kind of being that Missy Hughes has dropped out of the race for governor. We've been wondering, I think going into the summer, when are we going to see this crowded Democratic field shrink a little bit? It has shrunk a little bit by one person. And so she announced earlier this week that she's dropping out, and she endorsed Sarah Rodriguez.
Yeah, so, you know, we still have a big field. It's the end of June here, and the primary is, what, 6-7 weeks away?
Yeah, they're sending out absentee ballots already.
Sending out absentee ballots, so things are starting to get real. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Missy Hughes, if you look at the Marquette poll, given the huge majority who hadn't made up their mind, you know, you take that at the top. But then you look at where Missy Hughes was, and she was at the bottom, you know, single digits, along with some others. She had tried to differentiate herself a couple times, you know, came out in support of the bill, the tax cut deal bill when none of the other candidates did, kind of was running as more of a moderate, I would say, in this primary, which maybe isn't always a winning, you know, strategy in a partisan primary where you're going to have to appeal to the core of your party. You know, and she just made the decision to drop out. So she endorsed Rodriguez. We have, you know, the field still has six people in it, and we've got a few weeks here yet to go. We'll see if anyone else is going to drop out. It sure doesn't seem like it at this point, but often, you know, when you least expect it, something happens, like in the Democratic Senate primary when the candidates got behind Mandela Barnes and, you know, kind of negated the need for a primary in that race. I definitely don't see that happening this time around. But it is an interesting newsworthy development when we've been kind of waiting for something like this to happen.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're starting to see some of the other candidates spend money in a way that maybe suggests that they're not going to get out anytime soon. But what I was interested in with her in particular is that she's, you know, in this moderate lane, as you mentioned. And so for her to kind of throw that support behind Rodriguez and say, I think she said in interviews, like, I want other candidates to drop out. I think it will weaken the field. It will weaken the party for us all to be kind of, you know, fighting over kind of scraps of votes. It's also maybe setting up a sort of contrast between the more moderate side of the party and then the Barnes-Hong end of things. And so I think that'll be kind of interesting to see. The other thing that really jumped out at me is that she is the only candidate from Western Wisconsin. Everyone else is a Milwaukee or a Madison candidate. And so for her to not be able to kind of achieve that level of support from this area that used to be very Democratic, representing more of, again, that farm background, that business background. What does that tell us about sort of the state of the Democratic Party right now?
I mean, the Democratic Party gets their votes from Dane and Milwaukee counties, right? I mean, that is the core of this party. And that sets up a very interesting dynamic, of course, with Tom Tiffany, who comes from northern Wisconsin and is going to try to do something that is very difficult to do, which is win a statewide race and not be from an urban center in Wisconsin, Republican or Democrat. It can be done, but it's very difficult. I'm not sure the geography was the biggest problem for Hughes. I mean, she definitely had an interesting bio. It's just a very crowded field. She's not a name that most people would know, even though she did lead Wedick for a number of years. But it is interesting that everyone else, as you say, comes from either Madison or Milwaukee. So they will be coming from, you know, they will be pulling votes from the largest parts of the Democratic base one way or the other.
Yeah, absolutely. Other two kind of pieces of campaign news that came across our screens this week, I should say. Kirk Bankstad, who had said he was going to sue to get on the ballot and then decided he wouldn't. He has officially endorsed Francesca Hong, again, kind of setting up this like further left end of the party. I will note that he said many quite negative things about her on social media, I think seeing her as his primary, you know, leftist opponent when he thought he was going to get into the race. So that was kind of a bit of whiplash to see him going from calling her a clown car to endorsing her as the socialist with the mostest. And then Mandela Barnes has kind of officially gone negative, and I've been waiting to see when will we start to see that, right? There's that dance that they all have to do of not wanting to weaken the party but wanting to stand out. We saw a little bit of Kelda Roys at the state convention being negative by inference but not necessarily calling anyone out. Mandela Barnes on social media has gone after Sarah Rodriguez after this reporting came out that says that she took money from We Energies and then crossed party lines to vote for something that was favorable to them. Do you think we're going to see more of that kind of negative campaigning coming out?
It seems like it's inevitable, right? Because they have to distinguish themselves between one another, and typically negative campaigning is the way to do it, right? Negative ads are how you... You know, some people call them contrast ads, but the goal is to remind voters or tell voters how you're different from the rest of the pack. To the extent that anyone is paying close attention to all these joint appearances the candidates have made, they generally have played nice with one another. There's been very little difference between on the policies between the candidates, so it's kind of been a personality battle or preference, and now, with Barnes trying to draw a sharper distinction on an issue, I don't know that that opens the door, but as you say, it's kind of the first time we've seen that, and I would think that over the next few weeks, you're going to see more of that as the candidates try to, you know, differentiate themselves and elevate themselves. I think it also speaks to Barnes feeling like, you know, maybe he's seen some polling that shows Rodriguez being, you know, more of a threat, because he comes into this race as, you know, having run in that U.S. Senate race, almost beating Ron Johnson, having a lot of name recognition, that even though Rodriguez did win a statewide race, let's be honest, lieutenant governor is not the highest profile office to be running for, certainly not anything like running for U.S. Senate. So Barnes comes in with that biggest name recognition, and yet he's the first one to go negative, so that's very interesting.
Yeah, and does speak to perhaps Rodriguez kind of now beginning to establish herself as something like a front runner, because you don't need to go negative after a candidate you're not worried about.
Right.
There was also a luncheon this week about election administration, which is not always the sexiest topic, but there was some really interesting polling that came out about just how voters are feeling right now. Some of the top line numbers being a huge gulf between how Democrats feel and whether they are confident in sort of the security of our elections and Republicans. We'll start with a little bit of video about also the question about how to be tabulating early in-person voting.
How did we get here? Different theories, different ideas, that sort of stuff. COVID, rules changed, early voting, that sort of stuff. The problem was, in 2020, everybody went to bed and Trump was winning. The next morning, they woke up and all of a sudden, all of the numbers had changed and things like that. How do we speed up the process of at least validating and beginning to process these early ballots so that they can be counted more quickly and we can be done on election night? And you see that there's pretty good agreement with that. 53% say that they agree with this proposal. Only 45% say that they would oppose. I mean, the whole point is to get us back to a place where by the time you go to bed on election night, you know who's won and lost, and when you wake up in the morning, for the most part, it's still sort of the same thing.
Right. So this all obviously comes as at the federal level. There are all these proposals on the Republican side to try to change how voting works. And then election administration basically since 2020 in Wisconsin has been kind of hotly contested. And so that was interesting to find that some of these proposed changes to ballot boxes is supported by a majority of voters, Democrats, Republicans, and independents. But then, as I mentioned, there's this huge gulf in sort of overall confidence. 90% of Democrats compared to 46% of Republicans are very confident or somewhat confident that their votes in November will be accurately cast and counted. I think that's interesting. You know, it maybe reflects some anecdotal observations that we've all had, but you know, over the last 6 years since 2020, we've had Democratic wave elections, we've had Republican wave elections, and yet there is this kind of partisan understanding of whether our elections are secure, even though, you know, Republicans did extremely well in November of 2024, for example. That doesn't necessarily translate to feeling good about them.
Right. I mean, this is an issue that President Trump has just hammered for years and years and years and years, and he's still relitigating the 2020 election. So when you have the president talking about all these things and bringing up all these accusations, that the vast majority of which have been found to be completely untrue, a portion of people believe that there are issues where they maybe don't exist. And so and these numbers speak to that. They show the partisan divide in elections. Didn't used to be this way, and it used to be that people across the political spectrum had confidence in elections. And now what you're seeing is a yet another sharp divide and all these multitude of lawsuits and proposals and law changes. It gets very confusing. You know, election administration on a good day is very complicated and hard to understand for the average person. And I think that's why people who run elections, what they try to do is have a very open door and say, come in and watch us count the ballots. Come in and watch the process. See how this works. And that's, you know, sunlight is the best disinfectant. And that, you know, when people actually get into the weeds and see how these things operate and see that, you know, the election clerk is your neighbor and the people who run elections are, you know, your friends and neighbors, they can get a better sense of how all of this goes. But to the average person who doesn't do that or doesn't pay a lot of attention, it can be confounding as to why do we not find out who won until the morning? You know, why is someone ahead and then someone else, you know, and then they end up losing? All of these things can be confusing. It takes a little bit of effort to find out, you know, how this all works. And so I think these poll numbers kind of reflect that confusion that people have.
Yeah, and so many changes also, again, especially in the last 6 years, as people have tried to, lawmakers have tried to respond to some of these concerns. But that does make it also harder for the average voter to know, you know, what do I do when I show up
right.
to vote?
Yes.
Yeah. So that'll be, I think, very much front of mind, certainly in the primary, but certainly in November. So that'll be very interesting to follow. Speaking of the SAVE Act, nothing actually happened with that. That is that federal policy. But what did happen was this kind of sweeping bipartisan housing package passed Congress overwhelmingly, very few no votes. Interestingly, in the Senate, Ron Johnson was one of five no votes total. Tammy Baldwin was a yes. And then it passed the House with, I believe, 30-something no votes total. The entire Wisconsin delegation, Democrat and Republican, all voted for it, with the exception of Tom Tiffany, who did not cast a vote. But essentially, this is a huge package of really kind of wonky zoning changes or incentives for zoning changes, some financing changes, this kind of thing. The idea being that it's really hard to buy a home right now in America, and so it's meant to make it more affordable. And so that was sort of the story early in the week, was that this thing passed Congress. Amazing. And then Trump canceled the bill signing because he wants to put forward the SAVE Act, and so he's trying to kind of use it to pressure Congress to put it through. And so it's this kind of complicated federal moment. So rare to see bipartisan legislation pass in such a way. And then we're kind of waiting to see, technically speaking, right, he can't kill it by not signing it. It could just go into law. He could veto it. It could go back, but it passed with a veto-proof majority. I learned about the pocket veto option, which I think is complicated and probably not going to happen here, but is maybe leverageable. But again, we just kind of see these sort of unrelated things kind of getting all tossed together as the government tries to make stuff happen. The other kind of big piece of federal news this week was in the SNAP error rates. And so, you know, going back to when the legislative session was in session, our lawmakers passed a bipartisan bill to put $72 million towards SNAP administration. And that was because of these changes that came out of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act that essentially said if you have an error rate over 6%, you will start having to shoulder more of the cost. You may have to pay penalties. The initial numbers came out, and Wisconsin had an error rate of 5.72%, so just under 6%. What was kind of the fight that we saw in the spring? What would it have meant if we had gone past that?
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that kind of unifies, I guess, Republicans and Democrats is the goal of not getting fined by the federal government, right? Like not having error rates that are too high that we lost money. That was a big motivator for Republicans when they were negotiating with Governor Evers on this package. They didn't get didn't get there as early as they wanted to. They wanted to do it actually at the end of last year, I think was the timing of when they were discussing it, but it did come together later. And I think, you know, the seeing these first error rates come out and some of the states that were toward the top that were, you know, really off the chart, that they've got a lot of work to do. I think both sides can claim victory here, right? Because Governor Evers is the one administering the program, and Republicans helped get that money. I mean, they control the legislature, so they passed the bill that had that in there. So I think there's good news here for really everybody. Nobody wants to have high rates, error rates, nobody wants to, you know, have to pay fines or anything. So a rare feel-good story, perhaps, bipartisan.
That's right. Although, yeah, in his statement, Governor Tony Evers said, we worked hard to make sure Wisconsinites will not have to fork over $200 million in new penalty fees to the Trump administration. No thanks to President Trump or Republicans in Congress. That's for darn sure. So definitely a little bit of, like you say, different sides trying to take credit. And, of course, that that extra money that went to SNAP administration was also packaged into the ban on buying sugar and things like this.
Right.
With
that's
kind of
what
SNAP
the Republicans
dollars.
Got out of it.
That's exactly right. And that's, so again, kind of everybody using SNAP to get their political victories. Data centers is kind of the other big bucket of things that happened this week. So I'm just going to kind of run through some of the headlines. One of the big ones is that Microsoft finished its first Mount Pleasant facility. This is a 315-acre, fully operational, and it is employing about 550 people full-time. That's according to Microsoft. They are building a second data center next door, and there are plans in Mount Pleasant for up to 15 more kind of coming down the pike. So obviously this is a big sort of election year topic, and there's been so much sort of not in my backyard response from so many voters, but we're about to see kind of data from Mount Pleasant about what it means to actually have this in your backyard. And then this comes as there's kind of a juggling act around financial requirements that were approved in April that were aimed at protecting ratepayers, the idea being that you or I should not be kind of footing the bill of these huge utility gobbling campuses. Oracle America Cloud Services is suing the Public Services Commission, saying that these are onerous, that essentially they'd be paying an extra $100 million a year for financial security, for collateral that they would have to put up. So that is in court. And then at the same time, Xcel Energy, kind of on the other side of things, is trying to require data centers to pay all costs tied to new transmission lines or power plants to meet the energy demand. So you have the utility companies, you have the data companies, you have voters and utility users like us. And then, of course, this has become, as we saw, a little bit of a political chip in the form of, well, what have the candidates done to support or to perhaps receive support from some of these big companies. So many different kind of political stakes here.
Multi-tentacled beast. Yes. And really at its core, I think you have voters who are uneasy about data centers. They're so new, right? This is a whole new thing that's kind of seemed to come out of, not nowhere, but come very rapidly onto the scene. And so you're kind of dealing with this, like, what is going on? And then as you kind of ran down, just the highlights are very complicated, right? There's all these major players involved, and the environmental impact and the ratepayer impact and the energy, you know, all of this stuff. And then there's the politics. And so I think it's an issue in this Democratic primary. It's definitely going to be an issue in the general election. And we're seeing this all across the country play out in different races more than others, you know, where data centers are popping up within the congressional district of somebody, and that becomes a fight or whatever. So it'll be really interesting to see how this develops over the summer and into the fall, and how the candidates deal with that, not just in the governor's race, but other races, legislative races, certainly. It's definitely going to be an issue.
Yeah, and it's not kind of a clear partisan issue. There's not a Republican stance and a Democratic stance. Even at the state convention, the Democratic state convention, you know, they passed these resolutions, but they were much more around just like, wait and see and let's be careful. But then meanwhile, you know, these companies are coming in and they are not taking a wait and see approach.
Right.
And so there's that tension as well. Mm-hmm. There was also a decision out of the Supreme Court, a couple different court updates this week. In the Legend Lake Property Owners Association versus Guy Kishena, I hope I'm saying that right, case. So this is essentially a tribal sovereignty case. It was a lawsuit brought by property owners in Menominee County having to do with restrictive covenants about how land can be used. A member of the Menominee tribe purchased land on this lake with the intention of putting it into tribal protection, essentially. And so the lawsuit says, He didn't do it on behalf of the tribe. He only did it as an individual. So tribal sovereignty doesn't apply here. A lower court had said, you know, yes, it does. And the Supreme Court kind of affirmed that. And this was another one of these kind of liberal versus conservative decisions. So the four liberal justices sided with the tribe. Rebecca Bradley wrote her own dissent, and then Hagedorn wrote his own dissent and essentially said this should have been sent back, not sort of according to its merits, but because the United States should have been included as a party. So one of these very kind of complicated tribal law, federal law, state law issues. But essentially what this says is that people who are part of the Menominee Tribal Restoration Act of 1970-something, that applies to property rights. So I love these kinds of cases about, you know, like that again, bring up these really thorny issues.
Yeah.
I don't know how much that will be have long-term effects, but what's also interesting, I guess, in that community is part of a broader dispute. They've also filed a lawsuit against, I believe, the school board, the school district, rather, saying that, pardon me, that local taxes in general favor tribes over other folks. And so that might be a really interesting, again, kind of tribal dispute to be watching going forward.
There's always more disputes to watch.
There always is, yes. It keeps us in business. And speaking of disputes, I loved titling this last slide. It is a brouhaha, I decided, over the Sports Broadcasting Act of 1961.
Not a brewer's haha?
Oh, that would be quite good. But unfortunately, it is the Packers who are most affected by this. Yes, so I have never willingly watched a football game in my life, but I am in the vast minority of people, as I learned through my shrewd reporting. Football is very popular. And
breaking news.
And especially in Wisconsin, it is the Packers. And many people historically have watched football on television. And so there has been this carve out from antitrust laws since the 60s, essentially saying that leagues can negotiate deals with the big broadcasters rather than each team needing to. This has favored the Packers, which is the smallest media market in the league, and the NFL, which is the most popular league that people like to watch. And this, you know, treated them very well because they don't need to have a fan base as big as Chicago's or LA's or New York's in order to be played on TV. But now in the age of streaming, people who do choose to watch football might be shelling out $600 a year, or a season rather, in order to watch on Amazon Prime and Peacock and all these different things. So why is that a political thing? Well, Scott Fitzgerald chairs the House Judiciary Committee. They did an investigation into the Sports Broadcasting Act, essentially arguing that it is no longer fair from an antitrust perspective, and that it is, that consumers are getting the short end of the stick of this deal. Meanwhile, the leagues are making gazillions more dollars than they used to in 1961. And this has really kind of terrified the Packers, who say that it is an existential threat for them to be potentially, for this model to change. Tony Weed authored a letter saying, let's hold our horses. Derek Van Orden signed on to that. And so you have a little bit of Republican interfighting over the most popular thing in Wisconsin, which is the Packers.
Right. It's fascinating to me that Scott Fitzgerald is picking this fight or taking on this fight right against the Packers. It's kind of like mom, apple pie, Green Bay Packers kind of thing. Packers are not in his district per se. I mean, Green Bay is not, but obviously the Packer fan base is the entire state, right? So to the extent that voters are paying attention and understand, like, I think you did a great job running it down in very simple terms, but it can be very kind of eye-glazing, like, just tell me whether I can see the Packer game on Sunday or not, right? And so it's interesting that Fitzgerald is taking on this fight. It is in keeping with his kind of politics and personality. For anybody who remembers, he was the majority leader during Act 10 and, you know, showed no hesitation in taking on that fight. So that part doesn't surprise me, but it is fascinating with the, you know, the inter-party dynamic over this thing, the Packers dynamic, and just the average voter. You know, I could see voters coming down on different sides of it, like a Packer fan being like, I want to be able to see the Packers every week. I don't like paying for these streaming services. Like, what are you doing exactly to help me see the game? I mean, I think that's the question, right? That, like, the voters, like, tell me how this affects my ability to see the Packers, right? So maybe that's the challenge for these politicians to get across.
Yeah, you know, one of the lawyers that I spoke to for this story, he said, well, the good news is that Congress doesn't get a lot done, so I actually don't think there's going to be a change anytime soon.
Yeah.
But, you know, they passed that big housing bill, so
right.
You never know.
We'll see.
We are going into the end of the month of June, which means that a couple big programs are beginning to sunset. Two really significant ones, obviously the Knowles Nelson Stewardship Program is due to expire July 1st, and then these bridge child care subsidies that have been sort of an issue since COVID, essentially. Let's start with Knowles Nelson. How did we get to this point that this long-time, again, bipartisan stewardship program is sunsetting?
Yeah, it's a complicated one, but really what it boils down to is Republican lawmakers, especially on the Joint Finance Committee, had a lot of hesitation about some of these projects that were coming forward, and were blocking a number of them through a means that they could do that. And so it became so politicized that by the time it was due to be renewed, that they couldn't reach an agreement with Democrats and with the governor on how to proceed. So this program that does have bipartisan support and has, you know, historically had wide, you know, support, in recent years that has been, it's been kind of diminished on the Republican side. So I think the sense is that both parties, they couldn't come to a deal this year. They know that in 6 months there's going to be a new governor for sure. There may be a new control of the legislature. I think this was the ultimate kind of punt issue. Like, we're going to figure something out, we hope, but all the players who are here right now are not going to be the people, you know, the speaker and the majority leader are both leaving. So even if Republicans are in control again, there's going to be different leadership. We know there's going to be a different governor. I think this current legislature was kind of like, you guys figure it out. But it'll be something that, you know, Democrats for sure talk about on the campaign trail, about this program that, you know, saved these acres of land in your district, or save this thing that you're enjoying, you know, is no longer as of June 30th or July 1. And so they will definitely make hay out of that.
Yeah, I mean, and conservation is one of those issues that voters across the spectrum and lawmakers across the spectrum really care mm-hmm. about, just in different ways, and maybe have different sort of philosophies about how to go about it. A similar issue is child care. Voters from across the spectrum need, want, and are lacking child care. So there's been this kind of fight over child care counts, which was this COVID-era federal dollars that went into effect during COVID, of course, to kind of keep a lot of daycare centers up and running. That expired. There was a lot of fighting over that as well for several years. When that expired, then we did a state bridge program. And so now that bridge program is also due to expire. A report came out recently that said, you know, some amount of costs that were deferred, that were incurred by these daycare centers and then deferred because of child care counts, were then passed on to parents and families. And so more of those costs are going to either be passed on, or potentially, I think they said up to a third of child care centers, face closure potentially.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those issues that obviously hits about as close to home as can possibly hit, right? You have a child who you need to get child care for because the parents are working or whatever the circumstance. And unlike some of the other things we talked about that can be very esoteric, like data centers can be like, hi, can you tell me again, like, what's going on, or the Sports Act. I mean, this is one that you go to drop your kid off and the child care center is closed, or the rates go up and you can't afford it. I think that is one where voters understand it and feel it and say, why is this happening? And politicians will use that to their advantage to try to get those votes. And obviously, parents are both Republican and Democrat. So this is an issue that would seem like there's an opportunity for some kind of bipartisan work. But like the Knowles Nelson, it's most likely it's going to wait until 2027.
Yeah, I think, you know, Democrats in particular have really tried to own this issue and tried to say we are the party that can do something about it. And so what's also been interesting on the campaign trail is seeing the ways in which Democrats are saying, like, give us our trifecta and we will make Knowles Nelson come back. We will make, you know, childcare be easier for your family. And to what extent, you know, voters kind of agree that they're the ones who can deliver that remains to be seen. That will do it for us on Rewind this week. I am Uneven Wigtendock.
And I'm Scott Bauer.
See you next week.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrell Studio.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.